Do I have to pee?
You might.
I think I'll be okay. Right now, I think I'm okay.
Okay, sounds good.
I think. It's a tough call.
It'll only take a second. You can just do it.
Yeah, I better. Episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from sunny California, you are Cassidy Robinson. What's up, buddy?
Not much.
Okay, cool.
So we can pretty much just move on from here.
Yeah, we're done.
End of the show. Now, this is winding down. Semester's coming to a close.
Oh, you just said this. I was like, okay. are we ending? I didn't know that. This is our last episode. Holy shit, that was kind of a bombshell drop. I'm done. Okay.
The semester is coming to a close, and so yeah, I don't know. It's just in that like putting your ducks in a row,
right?
Phase.
And also, well, it's weird too because you don't have like the work, but you have like big work to do. And so you want to put it off, but you don't. I don't know. Maybe grad school isn't like that.
Well, this semester has been different for me. So I have one paper I have to write. It's actually been a pretty light workload as far as the end of the semester goes. I have one kind of major paper to write, which will be like 8 pages, 9 pages, something like that. And then I have this weird pitch assignment I have to do, which is all dependent on a group work, which is terrifying.
No, fair enough.
Our group has met once, and three of the seven of us have never been there. And I'm hoping that between now and the 15th, when we have to do this in front of real Hollywood people, that we'll have our shit together. But apparently, our group is way ahead of everyone else. That's been my life. What have you been doing?
I mean, we went to Kronos this week, but I mean, other than that, I don't know.
Kronos, yeah, the Guillermo del Toro film?
Yeah, I saw it in theaters. It was pretty cool. They're doing this neat thing at the Hollywood Theater called The Critics. Like, different critics from the Portland area get to pick a movie, and then they just show it for one night.
Oh, neat. Who is
they've got the Tenant coming up. He's from the Mercury, I believe. I forgot his name.
Okay.
I'll remember in a year. Ask me.
Was it? How did it look? Was it 35mm or?
No, it was just the Criterion edition,
Which is a pretty recent cleanup job they did on that. It looked good, as far as I recall.
No, yeah, it looks really, really, really good. So, I mean, there are some films that when you see it on the big screen, you're like, "Holy cow!" Like when I just saw Alien a little bit ago, that was like, kind of like,
this is how it was meant to be.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, I mean, you kind of get that sense, but it was his first, and I don't know.
Made on a pretty low budget.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if I got that much more out of it on the big screen, but, I mean, it's still a nice, I don't know, it's just, it's a different experience, so, and you just notice more nuanced things, specifically in some of his design work, I guess, is where you kind of notice. You're like, oh, that's interesting.
Right.
Oh.
Right. It's still a great movie, and you know, really indicative early on, like one of those first films where it really set up everything he was about.
Right.
Right. And one still one of the most like interesting vampire movies out there.
Oh yeah, we also did my wife's work party was this week.
Mm-hmm.
they had a casino night. So we like, so they like gave us like fake money,
mm-hmm.
and we gambled for like PTO and gift baskets and stuff like that. That was kind of fun.
Did you get anything?
They taught us how to. No, we didn't win shit. I did. We did learn to play craps. That was kind of fun.
All right. So if you want to be a gangster in the 30s.
Yeah. It was good. But no, I don't know. It was kind of fun. And I don't know much more than that.
But I shouldn't take you to Vegas.
Well, you could. I wouldn't.
You wouldn't.
I wouldn't be using any of my own money. You could give me money and I'd gamble your money.
And lose my money.
No, you'd give me like 30, mm-hmm. and I'd spend 29 and then stop. Because I was like, well, I didn't want to spend all your money. Here you go.
So it's not even that you're playing so much that you win 100, then lose 200, then win 150. Not even like that.
Kind of. I don't know. I mean, I'm not particularly good at it. I had a fun time. Craps is a game where you yell a lot. It's kind of like adult...
Scrabble?
No, it's like adult Catan.
Settlers like of Catan?
Yeah, Settlers of Catan, exactly.
I don't...
Like, the number, probabilities are kind of very similar. And so that's what kept reminding me. I was like, oh, this is... Oh, the numbers are like Catan numbers. Okay, cool. And so, like, I don't know. It's basically you roll the dice.
Right.
If it's on, then you have several bets you can go from. And if it's off, you're basically trying to roll, like, sevens.
I thought that like Settlers of Catan was like a tabletop game where you have like tiles that you put together and build roads and stuff.
Yeah. It's like if you mix craps and Risk, that's what Settlers of Catan is.
I guess. Why wouldn't you just say Yahtzee, which is already a dice game?
Because Yahtzee is more like five card draw. You know nothing of gambling.
I apparently don't, so me or you would be totally useless in Vegas.
Oh, I would be anyways, but yeah, but no, it's... But I know a little bit what I'm talking about right now. Whereas you were like, no, it's a dice game. All dice games are the same.
Totally. And so is D&D, exact same as craps.
Yeah, and Yahtzee.
And Yahtzee.
Because they all have dice. Because
they all have dice. Today, we're going to be talking about Rosewater, City of God, and The Theory of Everything. But before we do that, let's go ahead and get into the movie news, and I'll let you go. What was the big story that I posted the same day we posted the episode, because it was too big not to?
So they did announce the full big shebang of the Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be done by Mr. David Ayer. He just did the tank movie Fury this year.
Yeah, that's an interesting director.
Yeah, he...
For that type of material.
Yeah, I mean, he's done other stuff like that. Like, I've been actually meaning to, after seeing Fury, see kind of like Sabotage. And I've heard random things about it, so we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hesitant a little bit. We'll see.
I believe End of Watch is on Netflix, so...
It was, yeah. I don't know if it still is. Sabotage is, too, and that's the one he did the same year.
Mm-hmm.
It's with old Arnold.
Oh, I vaguely remember that. For the people who don't know, what is Suicide Squad?
Suicide Squad is basically this group put together by some dark ops government agency.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they put together a group of supervillains to do jobs that nobody else would because it's a suicide mission.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's kind of...
DC thing, right?
It's a DC thing. It's a little dark, but it's about villains that they're using in sometimes inappropriate ways. So it's somewhat popular amongst the nerdy comic book people crowd.
Mm-hmm. They just announced the entire cast, didn't they?
They announced most of the cast or who they're going to be showing. Like, we'll get into it. Joker. Who has never been actually a full-fledged member of the Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
They've cast to be played by Jared Leto.
Mm-hmm.
So
There was rumors about this a little while ago, and then he was kind of being sort of cagey about it. He was like, well, I don't want to say anything, which usually means nothing, but in this case ended up meaning something. Who else has been announced?
So Margot Robbie, the girl from Wolf of Wall Street,
yes.
She's going to be Harley Quinn, who has been a member and is kind of like the main squeeze of the Joker.
Right.
So she definitely will be in there.
Cool.
Another actually bigger and kind of weirder one. I guess I wasn't really thinking of him. I don't know why, but Will Smith will be in this, and he'll be playing the character Deadshot.
That is strange. This whole thing is strange. Like, this is almost... This is kind of like DC's answer to Guardians of the Galaxy, in that they're pulling from a comic that not a lot of people know.
Well, the people who do know it, though, it's pretty beloved.
Yeah, but, you know, in the comic book readers in general are a niche, and then this is a niche comic within that.
Exactly.
It is characters that are fairly well known. Harley Quinn and the Joker, Deadshot less so. But, you know, Will Smith has never... has he ever played a straight-up bad guy before? I mean, not really. And there was a little while when he wouldn't even touch R-rated material. And not to say that this is going to be R-rated, although it sounds like it probably should be.
I can see it could easily get away with a darker PG-13.
Oh, but... Okay. I didn't know if they were, like, out, you know, just shooting up people or what the whole deal was.
No, I mean, it definitely would need to be a darker, and the characters, you do want them to be borderline creepy, but I mean, it could, I don't know, it could be, this is one where it could be a hard PG-13 or a soft R.
Okay. Does, Deadshot wears like a full face mask, doesn't he? He's basically like DC's Deadpool.
Some iterations he does, and some iterations he doesn't. He basically has guns on his hands, or not on his hands, but like kind of attached to his wrists. And then his main one, like...
identifier.
Stereotypical identifier is he has this, like, red thing, this red-like thing over one of his eyes.
Yeah, it's basically like a sighter, like a gun scope.
Yeah.
That's how I've always seen him. But I've usually seen him with, like, a full ninja face mask, and that it would be weird to think that they'd pay for somebody like Will Smith and then cover his face the whole movie. So
He's had two. He's had one where he just has, like, an eye patch... red cider.
Yeah.
And then he does have a more ninja look, but he's had two different looks. So,
I dig.
You also might be confusing him a little bit with, not Deadshot, but, Deathstroke.
You know, I think I might be.
Yeah, I think you are.
Yeah. It's hard to say.
Are they both DC characters? Yeah, Deadshot and Deathstroke. They are both DC characters.
Okay. Then I don't feel that dumb.
No. They also kind of, I mean, besides having kind of similarish names, they have kind of a, like, similar notability within DC. Deadshot has been in more in Batman stuff. Well, no, that's not true, really. They both are kind of like these guys that show up in the Batman. Like, they're not main Batman baddies, but they show up in Batman, like, just randomly.
Yeah.
So
how do you feel about...
So that's why I thought you would know.
How do you feel about Margot Robbie and Jared Leto?
Jared Leto, I'm not just a big fan of his. I don't think he's a bad actor. I don't know. There's something about him I just not like way into.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is anybody they could get that I'd be like, fuck yeah, about with the Joker, like, at this point, really,
right.
Honestly.
Although at this point, given that the Heath Ledger thing was so huge and really defines Joker for a lot of people, like, that for a whole generation, that is their Joker.
Oh yeah.
In the way that Nolan's Batman universe is their Batman.
And there's really not a way to... I mean, it was a great performance.
Right.
Like a career-making performance, and it's... I don't know. It's hard not to... It'll be hard not to compare, and I don't know what direction they're going to go or what they're going to do. Well, this is just kind of an up-in-the-air thing.
Right.
And like I said, I've never been necessarily a hater of Jared Leto, but I'm just not a big fan.
I think I'll give...
I'm hesitant towards
right.
him.
Right, I'll give Jared Leto this. I think he always puts 100% of himself in whatever he does. Like, sure. He's not a lazy actor. Right. And he's a risk taker, you know, like, obviously doing something like Dallas Buyers Club, playing a transgendered person, or, you know, like, even his part in Fight Club, where he's almost unrecognizable. You know, what a lot of people know him from, probably, Requiem for a Dream, which is probably still his best performance.
Agreed. I do like him in that quite a bit.
Right. He's not a lazy actor, and I think he'll come up with something. I think it has more to do, in this case, with Air and how he's going to be directed.
Sure, and how he's going to be portrayed in this universe.
Right, and because this...
But we don't even really know how Batman's going to be portrayed in this universe.
True, true. Margot Robbie, I actually think that's fantastic casting. I have no problem with that. She's a good actress.
Seen a lot
she's
of
voluptuous,
her.
And she's yeah. We've only seen her in one movie, which is Dallas Buyers Club, but Wolf of Wall Street. But she was fantastic in it. She's a Australian actress and totally plays convincingly a Brooklyn girl.
Well, I think also why she might be good.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm a little hesitant just because I've only seen her in one thing.
Yeah,
but I will say that I think David Ayer as a director is actually a pretty good actor's director.
Yeah.
So I think that might be able,
mm-hmm.
he'll be able to pull something from her.
Right.
But
I mean, the whole thing could easily slip in the camp, like unintentional camp.
Yeah.
And
or maybe they'll just go straight for it.
Like, yeah. They're not even gonna... That might be the way to go, actually, given that The Dark Knight is so gritty. All right. Let's move on to the next story. The Star Trek 3, which was originally going to be directed by Robert Orci, the co-writer of the first two movies, who's never directed a movie before,
yeah,
is no longer going to be directing the movie. It says, reasons for his departure was unclear here in Variety. So I'm guessing the studio maybe got cold feet, or his inexperience was kind of showing, or he was demanding money they weren't willing to pay him. It could be 100 things. But I know that a lot of people were kind of glad about this news. A, because, you know, this is a franchise. Do we really want to hand it to someone who's never directed a movie before? Especially one that kind of already has all this stuff established and from J.J. Abrams. And some people are kind of nervous because Orci is kind of hot and cold as a writer. And I think, you know, a lot of his best work has been with Abrams because Abrams, I think, knows how to sort of shape his material.
He can be kind of schlocky.
He can be terribly schlocky. He also wrote the first two, the two Spider-Man reboots and the Transformers trilogy as well. Or now quadrilogy. So I don't know. Who would you have now step in place if you could?
Well, one of the rumors and one of the people that they are seriously courting,
mm-hmm.
Is Edgar Wright.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. I'm a little hesitant about that.
Yeah. Me too.
Just because it seems like he really does want to do his own material.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like he wants to play in other people's universes. So he's more than capable, so I would just let him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm fine with him developing his own stuff or doing more kooky things, like something like a Scott Pilgrim.
Right.
But, I mean, I think anything he put his mind to doing, it would be good.
I think it would be a different take, that's for sure. I don't think you could expect, you know, to have the same sort of feel and grandiosity,
yeah.
I think, that J.J. Abrams sort of established, that sort of post-Spielbergian vibe that those two movies have, or post-Lucas vibe. I think it would be distinctly an Edgar Wright movie, and that could be both a good thing and a bad thing for the series, depending on how it jived with the material.
Right.
I would throw in Matt Reeves. I think he did a really good... Yeah, he did a really good job with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Correct.
He's already of the J.J. Abrams Bad Robot school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he would just be a good fit.
Yeah, Joe Cornish was a name being thrown around too. He was one of the people that was up for directing it originally, and that's the guy that did Attack on the Block, and he's a writing partner of Edgar Wright.
Right.
Another person I would throw into the mix, but it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I would assume Matt Reeves kind of is not going to happen either, just because of other directing duties.
Maybe.
I know he's already coming back for the next Apes movie.
All right.
But another person I would throw in there that has similar, it's just not going to happen, is Duncan Jones.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I think he could do it. I think it would put a little bit more of a different inflection on it, but I think it would put a really serious, they could go in some really different directions,
right,
with somebody like him on there. But still stay in that kind of Trek universe and still use that same actors and the same, you know, so I think he could be way interesting.
Yeah. But I think he's probably balls deep in the World of Warcraft now, so.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with that. It seems pretty interesting, though.
We'll find out. Every time they show, like, a preview at the theater of World of Warcraft, like, game stuff, I think for a split second it's a teaser for the Duncan Jones thing. And then I realize it looks like video game graphics. What's your pet topic? You kind of cued me in a little bit early before we started recording, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
So all humans have this thing called like the tip of the tongue,
right?
Like experience, and usually when you use that, you're just talking about like a word you can't get out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. Like, you know the word. I mean, we have this every week with like people's names. We're like, who is that? They did this, this, and this, and then the other person usually throws out the name.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of actually have that experience. Sometimes I have those experiences with music. Sometimes I have it with, you know, various things. And so, and there's this film that I always think of, but like I can't, and I'm trying to actively find it right now. And so maybe somebody can tell me. So that's part of this quest.
All
right.
You have selfish reasons for this pet topic.
Yes, very selfish reasons. I want to find it, but I saw it when I was fairly young, I think.
Mm.
Or maybe it's a dream, maybe it's not real at all, and I'm just a crazy person.
You just made this up. Yeah.
There is a 50% chance that this is true. So it's about this kind of like movie guy, I think.
Uh-huh.
Or he's kind of like a, or maybe a business guy. He's one or the other. This is how clear I am. And he's going out on this business thing, but he wrecks his car.
Uh-huh.
And he wrecks it in this weird spot where it's like the sideshow, like freak show attraction.
Right. Is this like out in the like rural area or in the middle of the city?
In a rural area.
Okay.
Very, very rural area.
So he's on his way back or to somewhere, wrecks it.
Yeah.
So like kind of the setup of like a thriller horror movie kind of thing.
Yeah. And he wrecks the car, and basically he's damaged very badly. And the only way that the freak show people can save him is making him a freak as well. And then so he becomes a freak. And then I don't really remember much about it other than that. Other than, like, vague, weird freak show-ness
stuff. Is it Tusk? We just saw that movie.
No, it's not Tusk. because Tusk is a crazy person that literally tries to make him. Where this is, like, an accident, and they were literally trying to save him.
Okay. Yeah, I got nothing for you. How old do you think it is? Could you ballpark it?
Oh, if it isn't actually a film,
yeah,
it's from the 80s.
All right.
Or early 90s, but I'm pretty sure 80s.
And did you see it on TV or did you rent it?
I want to say I saw it on TV, but it was like Cinemax or one of those.
It was unedited. Channels.
It was unedited, for sure.
Right. And would you say that it was mid-budget, high budget for its time? Was it like a B movie?
Mid to low.
Okay.
Definitely a B movie.
Right.
Like it almost, like now it would almost be like I keep hoping that I'll see it in the Scream Factory.
Yeah.
Like what they release, because like it seems like it would fit in there pretty well.
Like
if it exists.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I got nothing for you. Can you even think of who might have been in it?
It's definitely unknowns.
Or you'll find out that it was like it starred like not unknowns, like completely very knowns. Like,
right, right, right. It was a young performance by Robert Downey Jr. or something.
Right.
It might not exist though.
Or you could have, like, made it
halfway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel like, was this something I was like watching TV and I fell asleep and I dreamed and I thought it was a film, but I don't know.
Yeah. My story of that, my version of that, and I probably have even less details than you. This is a movie that my parents were watching either on TV that they rented it, when I was pretty young. I'm going to say like 6-7 years old. Because I was still living in Driggs, Idaho at the time. And it was a crime thriller about a guy who was running away from a rogue Yakuza who was just, like, lopping people's heads off and killing people, leaving a trail of bodies behind him. And, like, at the time, it seemed exceedingly violent to me. And I remember having nightmares about it. This movie, it's like a, you know, probably, like, cheesy, you know, just exploitation
movie. How old were you?
I was like 6 or 7. So this would have been like 1992, 93 when it came out.
Could be like a John Woo film.
It almost kind of has that vibe, but in my head. But it was, had an American actor in the lead. It wasn't a foreign film.
But he was being chased by a Yakuza. I mean, but that's what I'm saying is it's still
or a triad. Could have been triad. I don't know. But that was the idea.
He might even not be Asian. It might just you be mixing The Fugitive and Highlander together.
Maybe. No, he was definitely Asian. there was a part I remember. This might help people if they want to email us or message us and let us know what these movies are. There was a part where the guy had to kill somebody and then he runs into a cop. And blood is running out from his trunk, and the cop like goes down and like dips his finger in the blood and is like smearing it and smelling it, and then he tells the main character guy, like, when your oil turns red like this, it means blah 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 blah.
Okay. Yeah, I can't help you either. That's not something that I know a lot about, especially of that era. I just
don't. Right. I'm sure it was some, like, you know, forgettable, fourth-rate Jean-Claude Van Damme type movie or something. But who knows? But yeah, this is the movie. It actually gave me a nightmare.
But it didn't have Jean-Claude Van Damme in it.
I mean, unless I was so young, I just didn't know who he was, so I couldn't have put the name with the face. Right. But no, as far as I recall, it was an American lead. He wasn't particularly like action-y, and it was kind of like he was running from the guy. He wasn't really like fighting all that much in the movie. He was kind of being chased. But like, again, I really remember very little to nothing about this movie.
Okay. No, I can't judge you.
Other than it freaked me out because it was full of R-rated violence that my little brain wasn't ready for yet.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't see mine too. Like, I wasn't having that weird of dreams at that time.
Yeah.
And I don't know where all that kind of like weird freak show stuff would come from, because that wasn't something that was just like around me.
Mm-hmm.
So like it, like a lot of the parts seemed very specific to me. That I almost want to say it's not a dream, but maybe it was. Maybe
there was an episode of the Batman animated series where Killer Croc was being transported from jail to somewhere
else.
Oh,
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and then he escapes and ends up like living with the freak show for a little while, and it was like almost going to be a redemption story, but then he goes back to his ways after Batman finds him.
Stupid Batman finding him.
Yeah, ruining people's lives.
Yeah, it's really horrible. You're a bad guy. Punches him.
Yeah, and there was a boy with flippers. I remember that. So it sounds vaguely like that, but yeah, I'm guessing that's probably not what you're talking about.
No, it was, I don't know. It was dirty and grungy. And it might not be now, but...
Yeah.
But please, people of the internet, find these things for us. It's been driving me crazy since I was like 16.
Right. Same here. I mean, I I don't remember the, I don't, it's that weirdness where you're like, was this even a movie? Did this even happen? Did I invent this memory? It's been planted in my head Wolverine style. Well,
did I elaborate? Because I've watched some films lately that I haven't seen since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I did not remember that part. Whoa, that's weird. That's some weirdness going on there. So it's, yeah, it, I mean, even things from when I was like 18, sometimes I'll rewatch them and be like, whoa, that was a weird part. I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
But
okay, well, let's go ahead and get into the reviews for the week. And before we get into the theory of everything, I'm going to do a quick review for Jon Stewart's Rosewater.
Okay. Is this going to be spoiler-free, or should I take off my headphones?
It's going to be spoiler-free. I'll do a very general review of it. All right. So Rosewater is the film debut from actor, comedian, talk show host Jon Stewart from The Daily Show. And stars Gael Garcia Bernal. It's based on a true story of a journalist from Newsweek who is an Iranian, and he goes back to visit family, and he is doing a story on an election that just went kind of badly around 2008 or so. The election, it was kind of like their version of like the Obama election. Like there was all of this hope for this new reform to change everything there. There was a hopeful kind of progressive leaning candidate that everyone was very excited about. And he ended up losing. And even though it seemed like early polls were showing that he would win, so it created all this sort of upheaval in Iran. And so he's there to kind of get a little bit of the reaction socially of what's going on before he flies back home in the States. And because he made friends with the wrong people at the wrong time and took video footage and pictures where he shouldn't have at the wrong times, some government officials find him and they think that he's a spy sent by the U.S. To overthrow the government. So he ends up getting incarcerated and thrown into prison and interrogated for something like 100+ days. And has to convince these guys that he is in fact a journalist and not a spy. And I didn't know this, but I think the reason he decided to do this is because he's a little responsible for why this guy got incarcerated. While in Iran, they did one of those goofy correspondent interviews with him, and some of the questioning, you know, it's supposed to be a joke in America, haha, was, why are you a spy? And then these government officials end up finding this footage, not knowing that it's a fake news program, and showing it to him saying, well, you just said you're a spy right here. So that would kind of explain a little bit why Jon Stewart's sort of interest in this story. It's all right. It's not great, and it falls short in a lot of different ways. You can definitely tell this is a first-time director. And unfortunately, because he's Jon Stewart, who already has this huge umbrella of success around him and support, he didn't get to make his like shoddy student films and then get to make his feature where he's learned all those mistakes to avoid. Instead, he's making them with like a fairly high budget prestige picture. But he's a little clumsy when it comes to exposition. When he decides to flash back or flash forward, a lot of times it seems like things were kind of saved in editing where a scene would have had not enough explanation, but then he kind of inserts a flashback in sort of a clumsy way. Sometimes he'll use voiceover in a really inconsistent way, like halfway through the movie. He won't use it for 40+ minutes, and then all of a sudden it comes in again. You're like, whoa, voiceover all of a sudden. Where it's a little unclear of perspective, like who's the center of consciousness in the movie, those kinds of things that are kind of important for this type of movie. If you were to connect this to something genre-wise, it's a little bit like a Shawshank Redemption type story. And it doesn't quite have the same amount of gravitas or power as that movie, because there's some stuff here that has to do with the relationships that I don't think is built up properly to really create the dramatic tension he's looking for. There's this kind of hesitant, benevolent relationship between him and his torturer, questioner, however you want to look at it. And you're supposed to really believe that there's this arc between this relationship between him and this guy as they get to know each other day after day, you know, trying to beat questions out of him, or beat truths out of him that he can't tell because they're not true. And then on the backside of this story, as all of this is going on, this story gains all this traction in America, which creates all this pressure for his eventual release. But that's kind of taken care of at the very end. And so we have no idea that there's this whole other story going on until we need to wrap things up. And it all just sort of dramatically falls a little flat. Like I said, it's made with good intentions. Gael Garcia Bernal is really good in it. The guy who plays his captor, whose name I can't find right now, he's pretty good in it. But I just don't think they have a lot to work with, and or, unfortunately, the right kind of direction to really capture what this movie is trying to do. Right. But as far as a curiosity of Jon Stewart's first movie goes, it might be worth looking at. I think he, having done this, could do better a second time around. Right. If he really wanted to take filmmaking seriously and go for it and, you know, keep making movies, I think he can work through the rust and eventually make something. It's not that bad. It's not like a total disaster. It's just a little clumsy and a little flat.
Right. He probably, I don't know, just from the trailer, I'm going to assume that they kind of overdo the beginning too, like him being in Iran.
Well, I mean, it's like it jumps around in the timeline all over the place because of these flashbacks and inserts. So, and that's sort of a problem, is that it takes a while to find your footing in the movie. But no, actually, some of that stuff actually works well. Like when I'm learning about this election and the stuff, you know, of course, we didn't ever hear about because we're Americans. Why do we need to know about international policies?
Well, you also, I mean, it's kind of how our news works.
No, yeah, exactly.
People.
And so you do get that, perspective, that sort of, that Jon Stewart perspective of cutting through the propaganda to see the truth. You know, that's sort of what he's always going for on The Daily Show is I'm going to show you what everyone's in the media saying about this, and through humor, I'm going to cut through it and speak it directly. And that is sort of the aim of this movie, although done with no comedic context and no subtlety.
I originally, the reason why I didn't run out and see it with you is because from the get-go, I was like, I feel like this is going to be a little on the nose. So
it certainly is.
Okay.
But like I said, not an awful movie watching experience. I didn't think it was like punishing. I just watched it and go, good try. Okay. Good try, buddy. Let's go ahead.
That wasn't condescending.
Not at all. Let's go ahead and get into the theory of everything, and I'll let you set that up.
Okay, so the theory of everything is basically, it's a look at Stephen Hawking, and it looks at his life more than his work, and basically his, like, a very intimate relationship between him and his wife and how that came about, and kind of the inner workings of that and what happened as the relationship progressed and his disease progressed.
Yeah.
It stars Eddie Redmayne
as
Stephen Hawking and Felicia Jones as Jane Hawking, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
It's, to me, this is like, this movie was like the first like 15 to 20 minutes of Up.
Yeah.
But just drawn out to 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
And it's,
So is it as emotionally impactful for you as that?
It is. I did. I thought that it was, I thought that they used sentimentality, but they used it in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say that it's like, it does kind of end up just being kind of a biography of someone. Yeah. But I will say that the storytelling uses the sentimentality in a very, very, and actually a very supportive and good way, and really is very human and very really beautiful subject matter.
Okay.
I will say it falls a little flat in maybe style, and in it just kind of comes off as a regular biography. Like, it's weird though, because at times, like, they want to give you like they show you this staircase. It's kind of like fractal. That's a very like big deal in like his type of physics and stuff like that. And so
right.
It's weird because they kind of bud on doing this, but then they kind of fall into this very realistic like even tone, and I actually kind of wish that they didn't. However, another thing this movie does really well is the performances.
Yeah,
this is definitely a performance piece. Mm-hmm. Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, they are just as much as fantastic as everybody's saying they are.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that some of the side characters show pretty good. I think Charlie Cox was very good in this as kind of the stand-in husband.
Yeah.
And then there's a character, there's an actor in here named Harry Lloyd, who plays like Stephen Hawking's friend in school.
Yeah.
His main friend. And it's played by a guy named Harry Lloyd, who's more probably famous for this really despicable, horrible character in Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay.
And you know, it's kind of nice because you're like, oh yeah, there's actors. That's good.
Right.
They're not like that in real life. So that's good. But no, I think I thought he was pretty good in this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I really can't say anything. I think the acting is the big takeaway from this.
Yeah.
Again, it does fall a little flat in style and kind of just, there are times where the film kind of shows some prowess, some directing prowess, but not often. One of those times is I thought the setup for him falling down.
Yeah.
Was fairly good. There's a couple of things that I wanted from this film. Again, a little bit more director prowess, a little bit more like oomph to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that problem is because they kind of, it's not the sentimentality, it's the fact that they kind of, move away from some of maybe the harsher or maybe some of the more like not so pleasant things or attributes. They tend to focus more on the positive. And so I think that kind of, I don't know.
The positive side of his disease or personality or marriage or what?
Or mostly, I don't know, like they didn't show like some of the, a little bit more of, like, I mean, you definitely see the hardship of her having to take care of him.
Yeah.
That's obvious.
Although I think it was vaguely funny. It was like, he was struggling, he's struggling, he's struggling, it's sad, 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 and then about every 15 minutes a new baby would show up in the movie.
Right.
And you're like, oh, I guess it's not all bad.
Well, that was, I also thought there was an interesting moment where he's carrying him up the stairs.
Yeah.
And he asks him a question. So let me ask you a question. And he's like, oh yeah, it still all works down there. It's a different system. I was like, and then they're like, oh, that explains a lot. Like, what's weird is that is almost like the Cartesian kind of like philosophy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost like a support for that. So that was kind of funny to me. But,
mm-hmm.
But I do like that it has a good humor to it, and it almost, maybe that's kind of part of it. I don't know. The other thing that I think the film does well is kind of show what it's like to kind of live with somebody with a disease and how it is kind of hard. But
yeah, both hard on the marriage and physically difficult and emotionally difficult. Yeah. I'll say this about the movie. I think it is a really sturdy piece of IKEA filmmaking.
IKEA.
This is like biopic 101 as far as, you know, the beats it hits, where it hits them. You know, we have very melodramatic music all throughout, very kind of insistent soundtrack that swells at the exact places it wants you to feel something. And it's, you know, there's very kind of a emotional piano score that runs throughout the whole movie. I think the director kind of comes from that, you know, maybe a little higher than like a Chris Columbus camp style. And I don't think that the movie lacks too much visual direction. I think there's a few places, and maybe in some places I actually think he tries for style when he shouldn't. Like there's these scenes where the scene is supposed to be kind of down, or he feels down, and he'll bathe the light in blue. And then later there's, you know, in scenes when he's more kind of uplifted and happy, you'll see more warm colors in the background. And there's kind of stuff like that. I thought that was a little hokey. But there's a few thematic things in here that I think help separate it from, you know, the general slew of sort of respectful biopics. And it's kind of these two weird quirks. There's the thematic stuff here of what I think the movie's ultimately sort of getting at, besides the relationship aspect of it, which is his place with his believing in God. That is sort of the ultimate question that he is confronted with over and over again, and sort of manifested through his relationship with his wife, who is more devout religion, and he is more sort of, he's a physicist and somewhat atheistic, and believes, you know, like, it's not even so much that he chooses not to believe in God, it's that he can't even mentally go there because it gets in the way of his work. And that's an interesting arc that he goes through, and I feel like it's actually, I feel like there was a more thoughtful and slightly more less traditional script that was probably more about that, that eventually it kind of got diluted out through more and more studio notes. Because every time it returns to that, I kept remembering, oh yeah, that is something that this movie's trying to be about. But it kind of gets drowned out by all of the relationship stuff. The second thing, which is less intentional, but seems it comes up a lot, is this idea of Stephen Hawking and his relationship to sex. The best friend character is that he meets in college, sort of is like, you know, it college or whatever, so they're like, you know, hitting on girls and talking about getting laid and all that stuff, and that's when he meets Felicity Jones. And then it talks later about, as his disease progresses, how he's able to have sex or not have sex. And then it talks about later these kind of surrogate relationships that they both sort of develop with different people. There's one scene in particular that stands out like a sore thumb and probably should have hit the cutting room floor, but I kind of like it in there because it's just so weird, where his nurse is helping him look at pornography. And so there's all this stuff in there. It's just like, what is going on? Like, the movie is weirdly obsessed with Stephen Hawking's boners.
I don't know. See, and to me, that's weird because you separate a lot of the sex with his wife. You separate that from their relationship, but that's kind of a part of their thing.
No, yeah, but
and it's a pretty, I don't know, in general in relationships.
It is. It comes up, but I mean, it's like the movie had that underlined somewhere. Like somebody in a studio somewhere had it underlined, like, how does Stephen Hawking have sex? And it's like, that ended up being a thread that runs all the way through the movie, even though the movie as a whole isn't terribly dependent on that, but it does come up all the time. So I don't know.
Well, you have to know. Well, people wonder, because where are these babies coming from?
Right. I think the one line probably would have been enough, but it comes up all throughout the movie. Emotionally, I think it works enough. There was a few places in the movie where I thought that it was getting a little too bogged down in its misery. I wish that we had spent less time with watching him struggle and more time with him with his science and figuring out these theorems and figuring out, you know, his place in history. He takes these big leaps in the plot, and you know, he becomes more and more important as it goes.
I disagree, and this is why.
Yeah,
is because, I mean, part of it is if he didn't have his disease, mm-hmm. he was lazy. It shows that very, very frankly from the start.
Yeah.
And what really kickstarted him is the fact that he got this disease.
Right.
And I mean, so to me, it goes hand in hand, like, and as a person, and I think that's why is life is a little bit more, is like that. And it's not all fluffy and I don't know. I kind of disagree with that.
Point, it's a difficult existence for sure. And you can't tell the story without going into that. I just feel like, the movie is almost, and maybe it's because the writers didn't want to have to wrap their brains around a lot of this stuff because it's really dense, difficult science to explain cinematically. You know, even Christopher Nolan just recently tried to dip his toe in some of this and totally threw off a lot of people. But yeah, no, I mean, I think it's totally worth it, specifically for the performances. I think Eddie Redmayne is really great, and it's a type of performance that could come off as mawkish or kind of showy, because he's, you know, limping around, and like, you know, as he progresses, the disease has to get worse and worse and worse, and so there's a lot of physical tics involved, and that could get kind of Lifetime Movie of the Week. But he looks so much like him, and he embodies it so much. That you don't even think about it as a performance after a while.
No, that's what's really impressive about it is, like, I mean, there he walks the line,
mm-hmm.
but like walks it like completely so well that he never crosses over. Like, there wasn't a point in time where I was like, oh, he's being weird. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I was like, oh, this is part of his disease.
Right.
Like, his performance never broke that wall.
Right.
Ever. And that's impressive.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of funny because some of the like notes that you have, like, I actually take points off of and you don't. And then some of the notes I have. So, I mean, I think it's kind of, I don't know. Do you think I'm more positive on the film?
I think it maybe emotionally worked for you more because I would have never dreamt of comparing it to the first, 10 minutes of Up, which I think, you know, so elegantly and effortlessly tells this sort of thing without beating you over the head with anything. And not that this movie beating you over the head, it just is what it is. You can't escape the melodrama of the story based upon the subject matter. But it is end of the year kind of awards courting type of material, but it's very watchable. And I think the performances help sell what could be seen as sentimental.
I'm saying it is sentimental, but I don't think sentimental necessarily makes the film
bad. It's the best kind of one of these type of movies you can go for, really.
I think that the sentimentality through the story making is the way to use sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
Is to really build it into the characters and into their arc.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, instead of forcing it on you, I don't feel like it really forces it on you. I think it's very natural.
Yeah.
In the relationship.
But like Rosewater, I would say that it is pretty straightforward. It's not very subtle about anything,
but again with the sentimentality, I don't think that's it. To me it's a style thing, and you're right, it does have random moments of style.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was also thinking about the very operatic moment where he's at, where he almost dies at the opera.
Oh yeah, that actually visually and all that, I was kind of like, is this a dream, what's going on? And there's another scene in the beginning that I thought was actually very striking visually, where he's at the, it's the falling in love scene where he's with Felicity Jones and he can still walk and everything. And they're at a outdoors college event, which lit with Christmas lights. And, you know, later we see the fireworks show and everything. I thought it was all very visually pulls you in.
Yeah, I mean, there are moments. But again, that's what I'm saying is there's kind of a disconnect. Because then there's moments where it's like just that straight, I do realism kind of like moments.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, to me, it's like he wanted, there's moments where he wanted both, but I guess they're thematic and they work, but I don't know. I think to me, it's more, it just falls a little flat, and I don't see a lot of director prowess is where I think it falls flat, it seems much more a actor's piece. And
yeah,
and even kind of a writing piece. Like if this was like, I mean, if somebody like David Fincher or something like that, like think of Social Network, that piece could have, if somebody would have shot it like that and treated the material like that, mm-hmm. I think it would fall flat.
No, it's not the subject matter. It's not anything in particular. I do think that the movie gets a little groggy in the middle. That's, you know, if I were to really knock something off for it, it's that there's a lot of time spent on isn't it sad? And I think that there's more interesting stuff in there, even with these kind of these other relationships and all this other stuff going on dramatically, than just watching someone's disease get worse.
Yeah, and I don't mind that the disease got worse, because again, I thought that directly correlated.
Yeah,
but maybe an answer to that would be to like make a more powerful one impactful scene, as opposed to a series of scenes.
Them. Yeah,
because I didn't think it was just that. I think it was also showing. I also agree it got groggy in the middle, but I didn't think it was that necessarily. It just seemed like it was less interested in that material. So if they were more interested in it, maybe it would be more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'm not exactly sure, but I found the main arc between the two actors, and usually I kind of go against sentimentality, but I think that this film uses it really well.
Yeah.
And I would just recommend it to people.
Yeah. It's designed to be a crowd pleaser and to kind of, you know,
But just being a crowd pleaser doesn't always work with me. I think that it does, just because it's a crowd pleaser. I think it's still up to par for people to just go see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is. I do think it says something very human in the fact that, you know, our relationships help us, you know, make some of even the biggest people.
Yeah,
and I mean with Stephen Hawking, if the movie is correct, then maybe he wouldn't have even moved forward with anything he did without this one relationship. And that can be very true with some people.
Well,
I mean, it can be the opposite as well.
That's the argument.
It can be enabler
making, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that with some people, it definitely is true. There are people who positively impact us in our lives. There should be a companion piece that should be about some other person that was going to be the next Stephen Hawking, but then met their alcoholic wife that drug them down into drugs and doing heroin. But I mean, you know, there's the two sides to every coin, but this is the more beautiful, like, human story.
Sure. Well, what about City of God, our Netflix homework? That is quite a different story, a darker turn, if you will.
It has a positive upbeat.
City of God is a 2002 Brazilian gangster film, also based on a true story. I don't know how loosely or tightly it's based. It's directed by Fernando Meirelles and Kitai Lund. How am I doing on my Brazilian accent there?
I don't know Portuguese, so I have a little bit of a trouble with it, but
fair enough.
But it's not on.
Okay.
I can tell you
that. Very, very wrong, I'm sure. This takes place over a long kind of span of time, from the mid-60s to, I'm going to say, mid-70s, maybe 10, 15-year period. And it sort of follows the street gangs, kind of low-level street gangs in the slums of Rio de Janeiro, and sort of these rise and fall of different successions of power between these gangs and revenges and turf wars and, you know, police corruption and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, most of these gangs, unlike your Goodfellas and that type of stuff, who are all in their 30s and 40s, these people are, like, at the most 18 years old. And then going down from there, down to, like, 6 years old, you know, people carrying artillery and leaving pretty huge body counts behind them.
Well, this region in Rio de Janeiro, it has a notorious reputation, and this kind of shows the rise of where those came from.
Mm-hmm.
But
This was your this was your Netflix homework to me. I'd heard a lot about this movie early on. I had friends who had exclaimed this as being their favorite movie of all time. And you obviously liked it enough to buy it. What's your overall take on the film?
It is definitely like a crime kind of drama.
Mm-hmm.
But what's nice about it is, and what feels really different and kind of unique, is the energy that comes with it.
Yeah.
And it is kind of a Latin energy, but there's nothing wrong with that. But the other thing that I think is really, really quite different is to show, I love kind of the denouement of the changing of the guard.
Yeah.
And how that comes about. And it's really interesting because it's kind of like they do this kind of haphazard storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it feels haphazard, but at the same time, he introduces people into the story at the exact moment that it needs to be there.
It's almost novelistic in the way it's told.
It very much is.
Kind of fractured.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's... And I think that there is a place for those... not everything has to be a three-act structure.
Mm-mm.
And I'm glad that... And I'm certainly glad that this film isn't.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's really light, and I think even though it's pretty long, like, I didn't feel it. I get into the little stories and the dramas, and...
Yep.
And you really... Even the, like, worst character, like, the most, like, quote-unquote... You know,
bad guy,
in quotation, bad guy, evil character. You understand his motivations.
Yeah.
And you see some of his failures and as a person and kind of why he is the way he is.
Right.
And so I don't know. And also, like, you're being told through a character that isn't a gangster.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's really interesting because in most of these, the people are the gangsters that tell the stories. Versus an outsider perspective and somebody who's kind of watching and somebody who kind of makes it out of the situation. So I guess that's where I find it hopeful is that you don't have to be just because you're in the neighborhood. You don't have to be a part of the neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. It's very Latin. Obviously, from, you know, where it's coming from, it's Portuguese in language. The entire cast is full of color. It's very regionally specific. However, the movie, I think, is extremely influenced by the 70s filmmakers, crime filmmakers of American filmmaking.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
I think there's a ton of Scorsese in this movie, especially Mean Streets and Goodfellas. In some of the writing and the voiceover and some of the style, I think there's kind of a Robert Altman-esque approach to the storytelling where it's, you know, sort of the fly on the wall and it sort of moves from one group of people to another group of people and they're all kind of talking over each other and that whole thing. And I think there's even a little bit of sort of De Palma style in some of the set pieces. He does even split screening and that kind of stuff. So whoever these two people who directed it, Fernando Mireles and Kitai Lund, they definitely love them some American crime movies. And I think they were really kind of trying to do their version of it within a Brazilian true life story. And it works. It's full of energy, and it is kind of all over the place, and it is kind of spastic, but that's sort of it keeps you on this sort of nervous energy throughout the whole thing. It's kind of funny, but it's also really dark, and then it takes these sharp turns into extreme violence and then back into, like, you know, a little a coming of age romance thing, which is the stuff that reminded me a lot of Mean Streets, and then back and forth from that, and it never lets you stay comfortable in one situation for too long or with one group of characters for too long before it moves on to something else. It flashes forward, flashes back, and it never feels like beginners, you know, like I was complaining with the Jon Stewart thing. It never feels like somebody trying to figure out how to make a movie. It feels like very set piece oriented, big bravura filmmaking, almost something like sort of the structure of like Boogie Nights.
Very capable.
Yes. Yeah. It's great. It is, you know, the things you've heard about this movie are true, and it's definitely worth seeing. It is extremely violent and kind of unpleasant for, I would say, a certain type of audience who doesn't like children in peril.
I wanted to talk to you about a few of the scenes, how you felt about them. But see, that's the thing that I like about it is that it doesn't shy away from that.
No.
That it talks about the truth of what's going on in those kind of situations. Uh-huh. Even in the U.S., like, a lot of gang members are young people.
We're talking about children. So, I mean, you never see that in the movies really all that much, but usually it's teenagers, young people.
Yeah, and that is the truth. It usually isn't these mafiosos, 40-year-olds that are getting their hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the ones that are out on the street. But, I mean, that's just the truth of the situation.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of weird to be put in that context, but I think it's necessary, and I think it makes the film a much more interesting. And the ideas of the basic crime thriller. I don't know. I think that this film is very capable, and it's kind of weird because we're kind of looking at three very realistic films, I'm going to assume. I haven't seen Rosewater, but I'm going to assume that's what the style was going for.
Well, they're all based on true stories, but they're all approaching it in very different ways.
However, I'm going to say that this one is probably the most capable and the best done of the three.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's just because they're pulling from... Because everybody pulls from films that they liked. That's right. Just the truth. You know, there's a ton of people that have pulled from all those directors and all those people that you've said that make crappy films.
Right, right, right. I mean, I think it's more specifically there's an urgency here. You get this feeling like these people are making this movie because it was going to explode out of them otherwise.
Yeah, there's a vibrancy, and there's also like it's just, you know, you're in capable hands, and you feel like the story matters.
Yeah.
And it really does. And it's almost, in plot wise, it's almost hard to kind of sum up because there's so many things that happen.
Yeah.
Almost in kind of like a Guy Ritchie kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I didn't even describe it in those terms of protagonist, antagonist, and those kind of things, is because it is, I mean, there is kind of a basic thread there, if you're looking for but it tells it in a very roundabout way, and you get to know these characters in ways you didn't think you were going to.
Right, right. And, yeah, so it's just a very capable and great film, and mostly I assigned it to you because I'm kind of surprised you didn't ever see it.
It was always on my list.
Yeah, and that's what I like about our Netflix homework, because sometimes it gives us a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody has that list, and you just, for some reason, don't get around to something. And this is one that I definitely think people should see. I do like this one quite a bit.
Do you think that Danny Boyle was really inspired by this when he did Slumdog Millionaire?
I was thinking about that after watching this just recently. Yes. I was like, maybe he was really influenced. Maybe he was like, oh, you know, maybe this is an interesting place to tell a story from.
Right. I mean, that takes place in India, but it's also kind of, there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
If you're looking for it.
All the evidence is there. I don't know if it's true or not, but.
I did ask on our Facebook wall if anybody else had seen this and if they wanted to contribute to our discussion. So we did get a couple comments from people you know. One you know very well, your wife, said she loved it. She said it's sad because the truth of it, but very well done. And Edgar Barrera says that this movie is excellent. It's the Goodfellas of Latin America, which is just about true. And if anybody else has anything to say about this movie or any of the movies we talked about today, you want to disagree with us or agree with us before I do this segment, next week's Netflix homework is The Source Family, a documentary.
I'm excited.
Good.
Sounds fun. Psychedelic, vegan, hippies.
Yes. So. I'm going to get into it. But if anybody has anything they want to say about any of the movies we talked about today, whether it be City of God, Rosewater, or The Theory of Everything, You can contact us at our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also respond to us on Facebook or just see the news items we post or comment on anything there at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also find us on Twitter @jabberpodcast, all one word. And you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And when you're on iTunes or Stitcher, please write us a review and leave us a star rating. You can also find us on the Zoom network and the Windows podcast app. And you can read my reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read the stuff that I contribute to the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can read Richard's writings that he does at his blog at rdwally.weebly.com.
Sporadically.
Very sporadically. And you can also listen to Quarter Life Crisis, the other podcast whom we are friends with, at quartercrisis.podbean.com, as well as Dampercast, Leland's podcast he does over in Olympia, Washington. So, until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.